These are not conventional times. These are urgent times. Let's be real. These are scary times. So the hell with all those conventional things. Today I'm declaring my candidacy for President of the United States because it's time to be brave. We have someone in the White House who we all know is unfit. Someone who lies virtually every time he opens his mouth. And someone who places his own interests above the nation's interest at every single turn. We cannot afford 4 more years of Donald Trump. No way.
That was former Illinois Tea Party congressman and current talk show host Joe Walsh. Life's been good to him so far, announcing over the weekend that he's running for president in the Republican primary against Donald Trump. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason Podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, colleagues.
Hey, Matt.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
I resent that. I resent the way that Peter always is, waiting and coming in last.
Spoken with conviction.
I just want to put that out there.
That's how we're starting this podcast, huh?
Next week, I'll try to beat
no,
you,
it's
Nick.
It's not hard, you know?
If I didn't realize it was a race.
Oh, you know exactly what you're doing, Peter.
Just like Donald Trump fighting the hurricanes.
I was going to try to go an entire podcast without mentioning hurricane nukes, Peter. So congratulations to you.
Why? We definitely need to talk about hurricane nukes.
So since we played a clip from Joe Walsh, let's talk about that for a second. Up until now, a pretty lonely, if lopsided, a GOP race between President Trump and former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, a great dancer. Just go out and YouTube Bill Weld dancing and Libertarian Party, and congratulations to you. Trump has been beating Weld by about 70 percentage points and out fundraising him 150-1. This race is now looking a little less lonely. Joe Walsh, who we just listened to the sustained applause of Bill Kristol and other never-Trumpers, is coming after Trump from the right, as opposed to the Weldian, wherever the hell, center, stressing the president's indecency, lying, and unfitness for office, but also foregrounding debt and deficit issues as kind of his number one policy concern, as well as tariffs. Speaking of which, former South Carolina governor and friend of Catherine Mangu Ward, Congressman Mark Sanford, is also still in his own Hamlet mode about a possible run, visiting early primary states and so forth. Bill Weld is still out there making similar noises, and newly independent Congressman Justin Amash, spending his weekends tweeting stuff like Donald Trump is a threat to liberty in America. He has grown government, centralized power, and undermined rights. He has promoted division and contempt. He appears increasingly unstable. In 2020, we must elect someone who will restore respect for our Constitution and each other. So, Catherine, should those of us who still care about such issues take some heart in the fact that the kind of center-right challenge to the president is emphasizing at every opportunity the size and scope of the government?
Sure. I like that. I'm happy to hear people talk about it. I do think, though, that the parade of folks who are showing up to challenge Trump and the utter hopelessness of their quest is a good reminder that electoral politics is bad and it's not the way we're going to fix what's wrong. Like, these guys are right to run and say, he's not taking the importance of free trade and the importance of balanced budgets and debt and deficit reduction seriously. They are probably wrong to think that their candidacies will make a dent in that problem.
Peter, building on that, the president has yet to poll in the year 2019 below 87% in job approval rating among Republicans. So are gestures like this kind of Evan McMullen fantasy land that looks, the sandbox looks bigger because it's a bunch of Acela Corridor conservatives in the media talking about it, but it's just kind of irrelevant to the project of modern republicanism as we know it?
I think that might be the case. I have somewhat mixed feelings about all of this, and I sort of want to summarize a debate that I've seen. On the one hand, there are people who are, I think, fairly understandably pointing to Joe Walsh and saying, this guy is a clown. He is completely ridiculous. This is totally disingenuous, just a pure attention grab. And this is from somebody who has been doing kind of pure attention grabs in politics now since 2010 who has made a lot of, by his own admission, racist or racially charged remarks, including suggesting that President Obama was actually a secret Muslim, you know, saying, oh, Trump was, like, as recently as like 2017, oh, Trump was right to call Haiti a shithole. Obviously, it's a shithole because it's run by blacks. That is what he said. And so, you know, this is a pretty convenient change of heart from someone who had, you know, he says, look, I played a role. I have some responsibility here. And so it really looks fairly cynical and kind of ridiculous. And he looks fairly clownish. On the other hand, there are a bunch of Never Trumpers out there making, I think, a reasonable point, maybe not completely reasonable, but at least partially reasonable, that, look, isn't this what we want from the Republican Party? If we're saying that Trump is a bad conservative, he's bad for conservatism, he's bad for the Republican Party, and obviously a lot of Republicans are in favor of him right now, but what we want is for them to turn on him. We want for them to finally understand that their positions, that the things that they had been saying, that the things that Trump is saying and still is saying are bad, and that this is a bad way to go about politics. And I find myself kind of in between those two ideas. Joe Walsh seems kind of ridiculous and kind of like he is just out there to get attention. On the other hand, it really would be nice to see a bunch of sort of conventional Republican types recognize some of the bad parts of some of the things that Trump is doing that I think are fairly destructive, both in terms of economic policy and in terms of the way he conducts himself, in the, you know, sort of as a character in the presidency.
Joe Walsh
just to hold on a second, just to fact check what Peter said to the extent that it matters. Walsh didn't say Haiti is a shithole because it's run by blacks. He said Haiti is a shithole and it's run by blacks.
And then he added the violence in Chicago is all black on black. Those aren't racist statements. They're just facts. I mean, he's very clearly implying he is making a fairly clear linkage between race, violence, and bad governance.
Go ahead, Nick.
You know, Joe Walsh is not the place where a Republican critique of Trump is going to come from. And, you know, he's now woke Joe Walsh. He's repudiated Trump, similar to somebody like Scaramucci. But the real question, if the Republican Party is serious about anything, then, you know, their leadership needs to step up and the people in the Senate and the House really need to start talking about repudiating Trump or working with him in a different context. And, you know, they're not, because they ultimately don't care about that. As somebody who, I don't really care about the Republican Party, so that's not my fight. But, you know, it strikes me as odd that people are like, you know, or conservatives are like, oh, yeah, we want challenges to Trump, but they're not really doing anything about it. And I'll say this, you know, Bill Kristol in a series of tweets said, in kind of praising the rise of challenges to Trump, you know, that it's imperative that Trump not be reelected. If you look at this from a nonpartisan position, like, is that actually good for us as libertarians? Who is going to be elected president that isn't Trump? And is that going to make the world a better place? Is it going to make it a safer place? Is it going to make a freer place? And, like, I say this as somebody who's critical of Trump, but, you know, it doesn't make me feel good to think, oh, you know, well, what's really good, because a bunch of conservative Republicans are embarrassed that their party nominated and elected and is supporting this guy. So they're saying, you know, in order to make me feel better about myself, I want you to suffer through 4 to 8 years of Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or anybody else. Like, that just doesn't cut it. And, like, it's a bad political conversation. I'm bringing up conversations as I always do, but it's like, that's a bad place to be. And, you know, and I refuse to be playing that game. Trump being reelected is far from the worst outcome of 2020. Everything depends on how other things kind of coalesce around that. Who's running Congress? What is the legislative agenda and things like that?
I would just add that I think there's a perfectly fine, to the extent that any motivation for voting and any reasoning behind voting is both fine and terrible. I have used in the past, at least, so that therefore this is terrible, the idea that if you have held office and you are in power and you acted like a boob, you deserve to get fired. I think that's fine on its own. Certainly applied it to Gray Davis back when I had the chance, and that was fun. Catherine, to Nick's point of that, yeah, we should be seeing some of this actually in Congress and places like that, but we don't. And that kind of speaks more to things. I had some discussion last week about the notion of, yeah, okay, sure, there's the 90% approval ratings for Trump among Republicans, but that would look different if only you know, Mitt Romney would have opened his squawk box more often when Trump acted in a brazenly indecent and lying way if the Freedom Caucus hadn't turned to jello after some pressure from the president and so forth. If there had been more active opposition from people, not just in office, but people who then tried to compete and win for their seats instead of doing pulling a Bob Corker and a Jeff Flake, then that 90% might look more like 60-65%. Do you think there's validity to that claim? Or do you think there's more just like, hey, dude's in charge, whoever's in charge of this thing that we've allowed to get too big, which is the executive branch, is going to get my loyalty because America 2019?
I think that, yeah, this is definitely a sign of the darkness that we reap. Do you like that,
wow,
Matt Walsh?
Makes sense to me.
That when we give the executive too much power. I do think there is an alternate history in which the legislature acts as a check on the executive and in which voicing concerns like the ones that we're hearing from the Republican challengers would have meaning, would have heft. I don't think it's about swaying public opinion. So I don't exactly know how that plays out in terms of the approval rating from the Republican voting public. But I do think the idea that it's winner takes all, it's the presidency or bust, does encourage more loyalty on the part of other elected officials in the party. Like, that much is very clear. And the idea that you would challenge the president and survive another election is now sort of an old-fashioned idea or one that's on its way out. And that's why we've seen so many of, that's why I've seen so many of the Republicans that I don't totally hate choose not to run for re-election or be defeated in their re-election bids. I mean, there's a distinct correspondence between people I wouldn't actually want to stab in the eye if I met them and people who are not running this year.
Yeah, and if you're a Republican in Congress right now, the only way that you get any part of your agenda passed in the next 5 years is if there is a Republican in the White House. And the only person who is going to be a Republican in the White House after 2020 who has any chance of being one is Donald Trump.
What does Trump do?
And that explains an awful lot of why of the Republican loyalty from
what is Trump doing that is so at odds with what had been the Republican agenda for decades? He's super anti-immigrant. With the exception of George W. Bush, the Republican Party has been absolutely hostile to immigration. He's not good on free trade, but to be honest, a lot of the never Trumpers were not particular free traders. You know, one of the things that strikes me as
I think Ronald Reagan was also not particularly hostile.
You know, Ronald Reagan is years and years old. I mean, like
you asked about decades, and if you want to go through the last three Republican presidents before Trump,
so
George W.
National
Bush,
Review,
George Bush
National
Senior.
Review. When's the last time that the Republican Party, with the exception of George W. Bush, who was smacked down after winning re-election in 2004 and said the two things he wanted to put on the table were Social Security privatization and comprehensive immigration reform. The original DREAM Act was supported and endorsed and partly written by George W. Bush. He got his ass handed to him, not by Democrats, but by Republicans. The Republican Party has not been a pro-immigration party since Ronald Reagan. And he left office in 1988. George H.W. Bush was pretty good, one-termer, not liked within the Republican establishment. The Republican Party has been hostile to immigration for decades now. So, you know, this is one of the things that I find frustrating about the kind of discourse around Donald Trump. And again, you know, look through my writings. I'm hardly a fan of Donald Trump. He is basically doing the bidding of large parts of the Republican establishment. And it's now people have decided they don't like him. And is it because he's not hawkish enough on foreign policy? Is it because he's vulgar? Because he's actually putting a lie to the fact that the Republican Party doesn't give a shit about fiscal responsibility? Which they have evidence going back to Reagan, but certainly in during W. Bush, et cetera. It's a weird thing for me as somebody who, again, like I'm not a partisan, but it's like Donald Trump is not that different. He's not a existential threat to democracy or anything like that. He's a jerk and a bully and, you know, an awful human being seems to be. But his policies are not so far beyond, you know, what the Republican Party wanted. And he won in a way that neither John McCain, who flipped on immigration in order to try and get elected at various points, or Mitt Romney, who was worse on immigration than Obama who was the worst immigration president that we've seen, with the possible exception of Donald Trump.
I think there's a lot of connection and a lot of through line between the party, the Republican Party of under Bill Clinton, under George W. Bush, under Obama, and President Trump. I mean, we agree in a lot of ways on this, Nick. I think Trump has exaggerated and encouraged a lot of the worst tendencies, particularly with regards to trade and somewhat to immigration. The party used to be much more split on immigration and used to be much more pro-free trade. And I also think that there's just real risks to having somebody who is as erratic as Trump in the White House. And that's what we've seen over this last week, where Trump has picked a fight with the Federal Reserve and has caused some pretty significant economic fluctuations.
These fluctuations are minor at this point. And, you know, anybody who is talking about the Dow going up and down, you know, even hundreds of points in a day, it doesn't really matter under Trump that, you know, if we're looking at fluctuations, the stock market has done well, the economy has done well. And I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, when you pull away from a kind of partisan, you know, discourse, it's not clear to me that Trump is as big a deal as we are wont to make him. And to say he's erratic, absolutely true. Do you look forward to a President Sanders or President Warren? I don't.
No, and in fact, I would encourage everyone to read my feature story in the new issue of Reason Magazine on Elizabeth Warren.
On how very, very much we would not like to see a President Warren.
So then what's the alternative?
I mean, I think many of us on this podcast were critical of the folks who, in the last election cycle, and indeed still, the last election cycle is still ongoing in many ways, and the sort of, well, would you rather have had Hillary critique, while a legitimate one, like, only gets you so far. And I think, you know, Nick, one thing you said is, well, Donald Trump is just doing on immigration what Republicans wanted to do anyway. And that may or may not be true. I cannot see into the hearts of congressional Republicans, thank Christ. But they didn't quite do it. I mean, there was some, you know, there was a sort of outer bound of the sort of thing that was allowed to be proposed in terms of immigration. And in this case, I think that convention was to the good. It restricted the scope of anti-immigration rhetoric and anti-immigration enforcement. Now, sometimes we're libertarians, so sometimes the Overton window is not in our favor. And right now we're just not talking about debt and deficit at all. That's sort of like a, you know, civilized people don't talk about that stuff, and that's bad. But in the case of immigration,
it's worse than that. It's smart people don't care.
Smart people don't care. That's true. It's not even a code of gentlemanly silence. It's a intellectual snobbery at this point, which is bad news for America. But I think the question of, like, well, isn't Donald Trump just the Republican Party's id? Or ego. I really wish I could remember which was which. Like, that might be true, but, like, the id unleashed is still bad.
There's a way of thinking about this, I think, that might be a little bit useful, is to distinguish between two groups that I think Nick was conflating a little bit there, which is the Republican establishment and Republicans or conservatives. I think that, and this includes sort of never Trump people, the Bill Kristols of the world. I think, contrary to Nick, that the Republican establishment was pretty free trade for a long time. If you look at the people up until Mitt Romney, who were nominated for president or who became president, for the most part, they had a more free trade stance than Republicans writ large. I think they also had a more pro-war stance than Republicans writ large. And confusingly, they had just lots of different things, both good and more pro-trade, then good and then ill than Republicans. A couple of key moments of where this thing switches. Nick mentioned McCain. McCain was, you know, a co-author of the Dream Act. It was the comprehensive immigration reform was the McCain-Kennedy bill for a long time until 2006, 2007, and it was when he was running for president exactly. What year are we now? 12 years ago, his campaign almost cratered and was written off as a death watch. He had to fire 2/3 of his staff, etc. It was because of anti-immigration conservative groundswell against him. And so he was basically frog marched and chose to repudiate his literally opposing bills that he had co-written, saying that, oh, you know, it's we have to secure the border first. This was the first step, and it helped him to win the nomination, a very contested and close nomination. while Romney and other people were battering him all the time on immigration, that was the first sign that the establishment caves to this part of the sentiment instead of kind of holding this distance. Romney then exploits that further in a set of policies that Donald Trump in November 2012 described as maniacal, which I think he was right then. And then Trump exploits that to his own gain. And now they're just off to the races. That is going to be Republicanism for a long time. And given that calls into question, I think, the acceptability of where Republicans are going to be at is, we're getting into areas of just lousy trade warring, lousy kind of xenophobic policies. We are trying really hard to make sure no refugee ever comes to this country anymore. And this is just disgusting, to be honest. You know, I was just at the Gerald Ford Museum in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is great. Presidential museums are the awesomest because of the little postage stamp part in a tiny corner of a corner that says, oh, you know, some people did oppose his policies now and then. In this case, it was, they opposed his pardon of Richard Nixon. But one of the photos that was moving, or little sections that was moving, was the way that in the wake of the Vietnam War and over congressional opposition at the time, he made sure that America accept as many Vietnamese refugees and started a program to help import orphans from Vietnam. And it was just kind of jarring compared to the current context. So one thing that, and this is sort of a transition into a Trump behavior here, one thing that Joe Walsh has already done that's kind of funny is that he's announced that he's going to retweet the following every day. And the following is this: if Barack Obama had ever, quote, hereby ordered, unquote, American companies to do anything, Republicans and conservatives would have completely lost their shit. This is sort of a direct reference to the president tweeting on Friday that he hereby orders U.S. companies to no longer do business in China. Didn't come with an order, but it came with later on Friday after the stock trading had closed for the day, an announcement that he's going to jack up tariffs against China still further, which then preceded a G7 summit in Biarritz where he said all kinds of contradictory things like that. Peter, where the hell are we in our trade wars? And what, if anything, did you learn from the kind of confusion that was happening over the weekend with a G7 meeting?
So I think the main lesson, and this one has been, it's been sort of, it's taken a while for this to become clear, but trade wars aren't good and they're not easy to win.
What?
And no, that's really what we're learning here. And that's what Donald Trump appears to be learning finally. Maybe no, not learning, but he keeps encountering this and then refusing to learn it is maybe the better way to put it. Trump is trying to negotiate with China, and negotiate in the world of Donald Trump often means making extravagant threats. And we have seen that throughout his career as a businessman, as well as his political career, where he's done things like say, oh, we're going to close the border with with Mexico. We're just going to do that completely. And that's going to be, that was both an appeal to his base to try and get political attention and sort of rile people up. It was also a way of trying to push Mexico on the caravan issue and on some of the border issues down there. He's trying to do the same thing here with China, and it is wreaking some economic havoc. The stocks are down again for, I believe, the fourth straight week. And the uncertainty that someone like Trump in the White House ends up causing for the global economy and for the American economy in particular ends up being a real problem. It's almost that the tariffs themselves are secondary. They're very bad and they are quite costly. But the real problem is that people who want to have supply chains that move back and forth, that move goods back and forth between China and the United States, have no idea what the economic situation is going to be in 2 weeks or 6 weeks or 12 weeks or 2 years. And that's because of Donald Trump. And there was a story, I want to say it was in the New York Times, but there was a story that was reported out where there were a bunch of central bankers sitting in a room listening to a big talk within the last week or so. And this was a major address that all of them normally would have been just completely glued to. And the entire time, they're all on their phones waiting for Trump to tweet, because that is what central bankers are now reacting to, not actual global economic indicators, not the underlying economic data, not anything else. They're building or trying to build defensive policies around someone who has bad and erratic instincts when it comes to trade, and that they really don't know how to predict and don't know how to
do. I don't disagree with that, but it's also, I think we're moving into an era or a moment where everything that bad that happens is now Donald Trump's fault. It's like, imagine you're Ilhan Omar and you're thinking about Israel, but instead you're thinking about Donald Trump in the same way. China, you know, there is a lot of unpredictability in the global economy now. And Germany's, economic issues are not because of Donald Trump. Brexit is not because of Donald Trump. The Hong Kong protests and instability in China, which has a long day of reckoning that's been put off forever on, you know, lying about all sorts of statistics and things like that. You know, it's not all Donald Trump. I don't think his erratic behavior is helping, but by the same token, we can overstate the effect of Donald Trump on everything. And in fact, I think it's bad to do that for many, many reasons. The first and foremost is that it's inaccurate. But, you know, some of the stuff that Trump is confronting in China, for instance, you know, IP related stuff, it's not such a bad thing that we're at least broaching that subject. It's clearly a major mistake to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, et cetera. But, you know, we need to make sure that we're not simply saying, like, everything that is bad, it's because of Donald Trump. If we get rid of Donald Trump, things will be perfect, or things will even be better, because it's not clear that they are. And again, when you look at somebody like a Bernie Sanders coming in, do you think central bankers are going to feel more comfortable having Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren as president? And those are the alternatives. It's not like it's Donald Trump or somebody good. Maybe Joe Biden, if he can still, you know, if he can fucking zip his pants up and Velcro his shoes together between now and the election. But it's like, we're not going to be in a new era of normalcy come 2020, regardless of who's in the White House.
I don't think it's correct to blame Trump for everything. I think it is correct, however, to blame him for all of the things that he has done and said, including suggesting that he might, by executive fiat, order all right. companies to leave China, for increasing sure. tariffs, for continuing to increase tariffs, for doing so in a way that has no rhyme or reason to it except to appear to basically just sort of be to try and bully and threaten China into submitting on a deal that they don't want to make and are not going to
There'll
make.
There'll be a deal.
And those and the ramifications, the direct economic ramifications from what Trump and Trump alone has specifically done are very real and should be laid at his feet.
I would also add that it's okay to criticize a president without, in every case, imagining who his or her replacements could be and whether that would be good enough
yeah,
or
agree.
Bad enough. Persons in power, they deserve a critique, regardless of anything else. Catherine, but to Nick's point, there are other ill winds blowing before this G7 summit with the Amazon fires, for which I recommend everybody listening to this hit pause and go read Ron Bailey's great kind of here's what's actually happening in the Amazon and here's the context for it. It's a lot different than what your friends on Facebook are saying. But anyways, before the G7 summit, President Macron of France, who is considered to be kind of the last neoliberal out there, in favor of these trading structures and all this kind of stuff, kind of unilaterally told Brazil to go take a long walk off a short pier in terms of global trade agreements with the EU in response to the Amazon fires, because they're under President Bolsonaro, they're not taking climate change as seriously as the French would like them to take climate change. And so this was already happening there. Meanwhile, Trump's walking around the G7 meeting saying things like, oh, yeah, everybody's asking me, the number one question they're asking me is, why does the U.S. media hate its country? And nobody is saying anything bad about my free trade deal. So I haven't heard anything about this. And right after he said that, tousle-haired British Prime Minister Boris Johnson had a great quote, which is, I don't know what his accent is like, and that's probably best for everybody. But
You should not.
Just to register the faint, sheep-like note of our view on the trade war, we're in favor of trade peace on the whole. We think that, on the whole, the UK has profited massively in the last 200 years from free trade. So, Catherine, is Boris Johnson our only hope?
Jesus, that's a... wow. I feel personally attacked by your phrasing of your question.
Thank
but
you.
Also, yes, that's a great quote, right? Like, I'm in favor of trade peace. Like, me too, Boris. Like, me too. I mean, I think the erosion of any kind of consensus around what trade deals even look like anymore has got to be really plaguing the G7 folk a fair amount. I think there is, though. I'm gonna try for a parallel to somewhat validate Nick's like ferocious contrarianism today. The Amazon burns every year, and this is what Ron Bailey's post says, that there's, you know, there are controlled burns that are done by farmers. Also, this is the dry season, so sometimes dry wood catches on fire. There is, at least so far, no clear evidence that the amount of burning in the Amazon is much, much worse than normal Amazon burning. However, everyone sort of wants to make a point and be up in arms and get angry and have kind of a cause. And so Amazon burning is what it is right now. And Macron is a great example of, like, he's like a cause celeb, right? Like, he loves to, like, get on whatever the hashtag is and, like, insert his socks into the situation. And, you know, this is, if the fight we're going to pick right now is about the Amazon, and if everyone's going to get up in arms about it, that's fine, because it is an important issue. But it's also, it could be background noise. Like, we could be choosing something else to fight about. And the same is true with, you know, with the Trump immigration stuff or with the Trump trade stuff. Like, Nick is right. Like, it's not totally, totally way outside the mean in many senses. But if now's the moment we're going to fight about it, then let's fight about it. Let's use it to make positive change. And I think maybe that was too labored of a comparison, to be honest. But the G7 folk, no one saying to Trump, gee, your trade wars are insane, does strike me as rather implausible. And thank you. Thank you, Boris Johnson, for making the point.
What is the point of the G7 at this point? I mean, what is the main agenda item or agenda items?
It's total mission creep. I mean, the G7 was initially launched to be literally the group of the largest economies in the world. To sit and discuss and coordinate to the extent that it could global economic policy in the face of whatever. And so that, you know, part of it would probably be jawboning interest rates, but it's more about global trade. Are we pushing in the right direction on the latest round of GATT or whatever was in place then? Is the WTO doing this? How are we responding to a refugee crisis? How are we responding to kind of this war? Then it became an informal talk shop. I think a disastrous, to me, because I'm a Russiaphobe, decision was to include Russia in the G8 because they're not one of the 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 largest economies in the world.
And Trump just suggested that perhaps we should bring Russia back into the G8.
He's been doing this for a while, which is inappropriate. They're kicked out because they annexed Crimea, and that is seen as a behavior that is untoward.
But are we supposed to be talking to countries? Like, is it wise to isolate Iran? You know, I mean, this is the type of stuff where
Nick, get a hold of yourself, man. Come on.
No, I'm just saying it's like
that is
everything.
That is the weirdest whataboutism I've heard in like a month.
How is that weird?
There's a group of 7 countries that are the largest countries.
Why is Iran there then? Iran's foreign minister is at the G7. Right now,
because Macron wants to. I mean, okay. The G7. To answer your original, yeah. I'm sorry, I rescind my whataboutism. I thought it was like, should we talk to dictators in general? Like, of course we should talk to dictators all the time because they're funny. They're there because the G7 has totally mission creeped. Like every other international institution, it's just become a talk shop for whatever the host wants to blather on about. In this case, Macron wants to blather on about climate change, the Iran thing. They're there largely to stick a little shiv in the ribs of Donald Trump. They are these spectacles. The G7, to give you an idea, they had this is in Biarritz, and one of their agenda items was global inequality. So let's go to Biarritz, which is a nice seaside town. Let's hang out in a Napoleonic chateau. And we're also going to make sure that there can be protests of this gathering, and they are 18.5 miles away. So that's what the G7 is. It's like it's a BS talking shop. And before even this thing had started, they had agreed that they're not even going to do their kind of flaccid group communique this time around, because there's no way that they're going to get anything agreed on with Trump in the room. There's a great quote, and I think a Washington Post story mentioning all this, saying some European officials said they were beginning to fear that nearly any substantive coordinated work with the United States might be impossible in the Trump era.
Perhaps,
I, by the way, to kind of call back Peter's critique of Trump's erraticism or erratic behavior, I mean, I do think that one of the really pernicious and problematic aspects of Trump's presidency is that he is alienating virtually all of our allies and even our enemies in different ways. And that, you know, that could come back to become troubling if we can't talk to people, not necessarily get along with them and stuff like that. But, you know, that is, you know, at a particular point in time, you know, if China is a rising threat economically and culturally and, you know, kind of geopolitically, and we're alienating all of the individual countries of Europe, you know, that could, you know, that's not a good thing. And if Trump has a reputation as like not even a double dealer, but just somebody who doesn't follow through on anything, you know, that's not good. It's not clear to me that that is, you know, unique to Trump or that American alliances haven't always been kind of fucked up. But, you know, that's worth thinking about.
And every country in the G7, for the most part, is going through their own kind of roiling politics of nationalism and also kind of a correction or corrective to the seven decades of multilateralism that has sort of marched along without much democratic input.
Trump isn't responsible for Merkel's immigration or, you know, refugee policies. Trump isn't responsible for the yellow vest. Trump isn't responsible for Brexit. And, you know, those are the three things that are really, you know, major, major issues. And the EU has kind of, you know, it has its own problems that have really nothing to do with the United States. It has everything to do with the way that they conducted themselves.
Let's shift gears here. Last week, David Koch, one of the two always pronounced Koch brothers, longtime trustee of the Reason Foundation, I think 36 years. That's what they said in Doherty's thing. He was on the board of trustees, which is basically since the beginning of Reason having a foundation to back its activities as a magazine and then later a think tank. David Koch passed away at age 79. Brian Doherty wrote a great obit. He and Nick did a great conversation about David Koch. And I just want to kind of go around the table to get one other takeaway that all of us might have had about either the man or the moment or anything else. Catherine, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I was struck, you know, once again by the, like, the man is dead now. He was super active in philanthropy and politics for decades. And still, upon his death, many of the tweets that I saw and much of the coverage was shocked to discover that he supported gay marriage and was pro-immigration and was a libertarian. And, you know, I think Brian Doherty did a good job of highlighting some of the ways in which David Koch's participation in electoral politics was in the service of a vision of a more libertarian world and not in the service of self-aggrandizement or even in the service of being particularly happy on electoral politics. And I, you know, I wish that there was more room in our conversations about people. I want to have a conversations about David Koch to recognize that. In general, we are at a real low ebb in recognizing people's good faith. And the demonization of the Koch brothers is often a part of that. And I think there's every reason to believe that David Koch was acting in good faith, trying to make the world better. And it's sad that people who disagree with him about the ways to do that couldn't give him more credit for it.
Suderman? I guess what has stood out to me is the way that he has been, that his legacy has been kind of compacted into only being about politics. And obviously, politics was a big part of his life, his political ideology, libertarian ideas, which I largely agree with what I understand his political ideology to be. But if you look at the list of charitable giving and the donations that he made, he wanted to build a broader and richer cultural world for all of us, not just for himself. So, you know, he gave $20 million to the American Museum of Natural History, which named the dinosaur wing after him, which is awesome because dinosaurs are awesome. $65 million to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, $100 million to the Lincoln Center. And he also gave a lot of money to health causes, in particular to cancer research, something like $150 million to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And that's just a small selection of his giving that wasn't specifically political. And yet, all of the conversation, or nearly all of the conversation, after his death has revolved around his political ideology. And I think not that his political ideology wasn't important to his identity and to his life and to Reason Magazine, but I think it's a little disappointing that it has been that reductive and not recognized him as somebody who wanted to change the world in a lot of ways and who lived in a lot of ways, I think, his libertarian ideology, his sense that individuals had the power to change the world, not using government means, but through private means. He helped a lot of that happen.
Nick?
I think that the ultimate legacy of David Koch is that he and Charles Koch, his brother as well, they represent an alternative to the way that we are taught to talk about politics in terms of conservative and liberal, right wing and left wing. And when you look, and particularly, I mean, going back to the 1980 Libertarian Party campaign platform, where he was the vice presidential candidate, it is a truly radical document. And there's parts of it that have not aged particularly well. But, you know, what comes through is the idea of a principled alternative to economic, you know, kind of economic libertarianism and social conservatism, or social libertarianism and economic regulation. David Koch really defined an alternative and helped fund that alternative and helped create people who could think about how does that alternative work in the real world and whatnot. And the inability of people to kind of comprehend that or apprehend that, I like to think, is ending. And there's an analog on the kind of progressive left, where somebody like George Soros is often put into a kind of, well, he's a socialist billionaire or something like that. And he's not that at all. You know, and hopefully we're getting to a point where we are recognizing that the categories that we are trying to use to define different types of ideologies that are better ideologies, such as libertarianism, you know, we're finally getting to a point where we're going to start embracing or debating libertarian ideas rather than what we are more comfortable debating, which is a phantom version of conservatism or liberalism. So I think David Koch's legacy is that he actually laid out and lived a principled libertarian commitment to a lot of stuff. And that helps explain why so much of his giving was not political, because ultimately the whole point of libertarian ideas is that the world beyond politics, and where you need a consensus, where you need a vote that people are going to be bound by, should be the smallest parts of our lives.
I wrote a post a week or two ago about Bernie Sanders' various conspiracy theorizing and his the course of his career, let alone about the media this year and Washington Post and Jeff Bezos. And the Koch brothers is right in the center of it all. They just go on his website. I think it's a senatorial website, too. And he has an entry for the Koch brothers, and in which he claims that, you know, they totally control the Republican Party, obviously. And here's the evidence of how pernicious that's going to be. And then he lists all the part of the 1980 Libertarian Party platform. He lists all the part that have nothing to do with all the various social or criminal justice issues, which Bernie Sanders would eventually come around to agreeing with the Koch brothers on. So it's like, here's this list of issues in which
he wants to get rid of the Department of Commerce and the Federal Trade
stuff
Commission.
That Republicans have completely dropped and is not part of anything. You know, the Republican Party is led by, at this point, someone that the Koch brothers obviously were not fond of here. I think, to build on the Nick's George Soros comp, I've met David Koch twice. People have a conception of what it means to be a board member of a foundation. We have a great board, Nick and Catherine and I can attest. And in my editorial tenure, it meets twice a year. In our editorial tenure, I've met him, I think, twice, both times in the context of having a board meeting at his office. And then we had an event with him in New York, and that's it. And the first time that I met him, in which I just shook his hand and said, thanks, he was walking around, this might have been like 2011 or 12, kind of at the top of the Jane Meyer-led demonization of the Koch brothers as all that is wrong in this world. He was just kind of bewildered at the amount of not just negative attention, but like death threats aimed at him and his brother and their families. And sort of was talking about how they have to have bodyguards at all times. And he was kind of shook up by this. I have no doubt that George Soros experienced similar things once he too, late in life, got heavily involved in major party presidential politics after several decades. There's great comps between the Kochs and George Soros in that most of their giving was deliberately not political. It was on issue basis, some of which they agree on, you know, especially having to do with the criminal justice system.
And foreign policy.
And foreign policy. And as we've seen, and we talked about here on this podcast recently, there's a new foreign policy organization that has started up with both Koch and Soros active involvement in, which I hope signals that we're going to get a new Jane Meyer boogeyman here in this world and recognize that, you know, they both those families took their shot. I think major party politics does not make you, does not make your alliances, does not make anything about you necessarily smarter. It tends to reduce everyone into binaries. So hopefully there's some kind of new either super pro-Trump or super anti-Trump boogeyman, or maybe we don't need to have boogeyman after all. You know, maybe we can assess people on their own merits. But this cycle of the last 20 years of you have to completely hate one or both, and they have a disproportionate power beyond the realms of human comprehension. It's been ugly to observe and just kind of stupid. You know, nobody has as much power as you think that they do for the most part. Not even the banksters, Nick, have that much power. And so rest in peace, David Koch. All right, let's go to our end of show. What you have been consuming. Nick, have you been consuming sports news again?
I have been consuming sports news, and I'm kind of glad to see a major football player actually saying, you know what, I'm leaving because I don't want to be a vegetable or commit suicide later. So, you know, the end of the Indianapolis Colts quarterback, a first-round draft pick, leaving the game voluntarily is a wake-up call. It's not even a wake-up call. It's actually a milepost to the decline of football as the most kind of profitable watched sport in America. Having said that, I haven't been consuming that much of that, and I watched the second season of Mindhunter, the Netflix series about profilers in the late 70s and early 80s of the FBI. And if you are of a certain age, and Matt, I think you're a part of this, it is a weird nostalgia show because the main characters go around and they interview serial killers or multiple murderers, as they were called. The term serial killer really wasn't popularized until the mid to late 80s. But so, you know, it's reprising a bizarre moment in American history when a lot of popular culture was built around things like, you know, Ted Bundy, Charles Manson, the Atlanta child murders, you know, et cetera. The reports coming out of Wichita in the 70s and early 80s of the BTK killer. You know, to have grown up in the late 70s and the early 80s is to have grown up in an America that was, you know, haunted by, you know, kind of random killings that were elaborately described by people who were insane. And Mindhunter, very good show. Interesting nostalgia trip.
Suderman?
I have been consuming a lot of Star Wars news because there was a big Disney expo in which they announced like the next 50 years of Star Wars products. No, not really. But they have confirmed that there is going to be an Obi-Wan TV show on Disney Plus, the new streaming service launching this fall, that's going to star Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan Kenobi. They have confirmed that there is going to be a Star Wars hotel experience. So it's going to not be on the water, but the idea is that it's like a cruise ship. Like everybody enters at the same time and you're there for 48 hours. And the deeper you, like the lower levels of the hotel, you will be able to like kind of explore them and encounter in-world stories that you will in games and sort of adventures. So almost like a real-life role-playing game set in a Star Wars universe, but it's actually a hotel that is totally run by Disney. And every room, every window will have a view of the stars outside, including the window in your hotel room. It sounds kind of fantastic and strange. And there is a new trailer for the J.J. Abrams-directed Star Wars Episode 9 that just came out this morning.
Oh.
As well as the first trailer for The Mandalorian, which is the first Star Wars television series that's going to be airing on Disney Plus. So you can pretty much make plans right now to never watch anything that isn't Star Wars or Marvel for the rest of your life. And Disney will be very happy to take your time eyeballs and money.
That's going to be fantastic news to my 11-year-old who is all in on all of it right now. I read during my summer vacation the memoir by former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, called The Education of an Idealist. I'll be writing this up. That's
did
that's
you just snort?
Rude. He rudely snorted
so
at Samantha
bad.
Power.
The not the miseducation
of Lauren B. Power.
Yeah,
it is a fascinating glimpse into a mindset of what might be called liberal internationalism. I don't want to spoil what I will write about it later.
Is it worth reading?
It's if you're interested in American foreign policy and the views of someone who is as likely as anybody else to be the next Democratic administration Secretary of State.
Would that be a disaster?
Everything is a disaster, Nick. She has not, to my mind, learned the crucial lesson of what happens when you take your anti-genocideness, which is kind of how she got her start in policy, politics, and literary fame, and apply it kind of willy-nilly, regardless of power strictures in places like Libya. Does not seem to have learned much of any lesson from that, which I find deeply worrying. But I will cut it off there because I want to write more and talk less. Catherine, what have you been consuming? Take us out.
I read The Ghost Talkers by Mary Robinette Kowal. I was inspired to do that because her novel, The Calculating Stars, won a Hugo earlier this month. And I remembered that I had loved it and recommended it indeed on this podcast. And so I thought I should read some more books by this awesome gal. In general, I commend to you this year's Hugo winners, which are a real greatest hits of things that Catherine Mangu Ward likes, which may or may not. I guess I will commend it to you if that sounds appealing to you.
It does.
Including an episode of The Good Place, a show I have often discussed on this here pod, which won Mary Robinette Kowal's novel, of course, which is extremely good, about lady astronauts. Also, Peter Suderman's fave Into the Spider-Verse for long-form dramatic presentation. And although this is more of a Jesse Walker vibe, the Best Related Work Prize, which went to, as far as I can tell, kind of like all of fan fiction on the internet. It went to Archive of Our Own, which seems to be like the repository for fan fiction. And Jesse Walker has taught me to like love and cherish the weirdness of that section of the internet. And I am happy that it got official recognition. So read some historical fantasy about wartime spiritual mediums, read about some lady astronauts, or go read about all of your favorite characters probably having sex with each other on the internet.
Or watch a movie about a lot of different Spider-Men.
Or watch a movie about a lot of different Spider-Men.
Spider-Men? Spider-Women?
Spider-Pigs?
Things.
Spider-Them.
Spider-Them.
Spider-Thems.
We're all Spider-Men.
Spider-Xs. Anyway, that's my recommendation. Enjoy the science fiction, everyone.
That's all the science fiction we have time for here at the Editor's Roundtable, the Reason Podcast. Thank you for listening. Did we solicit some specific suggestion last time, Catherine Mangu Ward? Is my brain remembering this correctly? Didn't we want people to like vote on something?
I don't think we made a decision on
that. Well, we asked people to vote on my new slogan for Reason Magazine, a high-capacity magazine that is soon to be banned, and I got lots of positive feedback. You haters. So that's Reason's new slogan.
It's funny. Okay. We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening and goodbye.